Hello, and welcome to I Am the Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. And welcome back to part two of Chaos and Creation in the Backyard with Dan Schreiber.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me back. Let's do this.
Thank you. Let's do it.
Laugh when your eyes are burning. Smile when your heart is filled with pain. Sigh as you brush away your sorrow. Make a vow that it's not gonna happen again. It's not right in one life too much rain.
So next we have Too Much Rain.
Too Much Rain is a very nice song on the album. Once again, through the research of it, has transformed this song for me, because it turns out that this song was largely based on what is also one of my favorite songs of all time, which is Smile, which was written by Charlie Chaplin. He did the orchestration and the music. Lyrics were added to it much later, the lyrics that we know and love. Smile while your heart is breaking. And again, for me, my love of finding these Beatles comedy connections, the idea that Paul has a song on this album, which is a Charlie Chaplin tribute song, basically, and you listen to it at the beginning and you can hear the smile chords in it. You can hear the progression, and the lyrics as well contain laugh when your eyes are burning, smile when your heart is filled with pain, laugh when your eyes are burning, smile. It's you know, he's smile while you're, you know, that's it's, he's using lyrics and chords exactly the same. So again, this has gone from a song that I like to a song that I've now really connected to, knowing his influences off the back of it.
And again, a song for Heather. She'd been through a lot. You know, she'd been through a lot before she even got together with Paul and that sort of messy divorce. You know, she'd been through hell. And this is Paul trying to be positive for her. The weird thing about this one, I find, for me anyway, is that Paul is always positive. But in this song, his encouragement doesn't seem to offer as much light at the end of the tunnel as a lot of his other songs do. So it's things like it's too much for anyone, too hard for anyone. Who wants a happy and peaceful life? You got to learn to laugh. And it's kind of it's not that comforting, really, as a, you know, it's you'll be right, just laugh. For me, I don't know.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think that's kind of, weirdly, that has all the feel of a Charlie Chaplin movie, though, as well. It's life is tragic, but you've got to sort of dust off your hat, swivel your cane, and walk off into the sunset for another adventure. So this is a Heather song, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. And is that him in interviews, or is this you two beers in, chucking a theory out there?
No. Yeah, I'm quite happy to do that. But he said it was inspired by Heather. And his quote was, she'd had a lot of tough times in her life.
She had. I remember my auntie and uncle had her biography in France. So just after I left Kosovo, I went to stay with my auntie and uncle in the south of France. And then I came over to England as a quick trip to meet my auntie and say hi, but I ended up staying here 16 years later. I'm still here, but I wasn't meant to really be here. So France was meant to be the last pit stop of my trip after Kosovo, and then go back home to Australia. And they had in their library Heather Mills's autobiography. And yeah, I mean, it was a pretty full on life. I didn't read the full thing, but I got the gist through flicking through it. And then it's such a shame when they broke up, all the dirt that's able to be flung out, and all the stuff about the soft core sort of Kama Sutra joy of sex photos that she took for whatever book. And I feel
published
really
by the
bad
newspapers that were publishing exactly that, you know,
yes,
on page three.
Exactly, going shameful. Yeah. And I don't know. I'm really defensive, I think, over, even though I know the pain that it's been causing everyone involved. But when I hear about hatred towards Yoko Ono or Linda, or I just feel so bad about how they're portrayed. I mean, regardless of what Yoko might or might not have done to the Beatles, she's owed a fucking fat apology by the British press for what they said about her in the headlines. Like, it just out of common decency. And we look at it now, everyone goes on about how Monica Lewinsky was treated horribly by the media, and she's managed to turn that round, and apologies have come out left, right, and center. Of course, why was she blamed at the time? It was this guy, and she got all the shit. Yoko's never formally received a big apology, and that's just, who cares what her character's like? Who cares what she may or may not have done? Our response was not the good response as humans to her, and she still hasn't. Even after all this Me Too stuff has come out, no one has still gone, should we apologize to Yoko? Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? Because we put her through fucking hell, and it was racist, and it was misogynistic, and it was just horrific. And Heather was the second version of that. She got to experience in a soft way what Yoko went through, and once that ball's rolling, what do you do? Like, even if Paul was saying, please leave her alone, it's out of his hands, you know. Of course she would have to come back with stuff like, he would take my leg, and, you know, all that stuff that she said that was about him. And who knows if she ever said that? It's just so hard to know.
Yeah, you don't.
Well, maybe we do know about that. There might be direct quotes, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of agendas at the time. I remember at the time Paul was noticeably quiet. You know, he didn't make any quotes at the time. But, you know, the album, this album and the following album are pretty well his quotes. He's kind of left it for us to work it out ourselves, I think.
Yeah.
As described by the next song, I could be on Radio 2.
A certain softness in her eyes fascinates me more than I ever thought it would. A certain softness, more than I ever thought it could. A certain softness in her eyes got me hooked, got me hooked.
Track 8, A Certain Softness.
Really beautiful ballad, really lovely love song. And also, what I quite like, because this is one of the few songs on the album where there's other contributors to it. So there's a different drummer on this one. There's someone on the guitars, and there's a few of those songs on this album. But majoritively, it is McCartney and maybe Nigel. So this one was recorded in LA, I believe. Yes. Definitely in America. And as a result, I just really like the contributors to the songs. Again, looked them up for the sake of this show. And so on drums is Johnny Waronka, who, he's a really cool guy because he's just, you know, he's played drums for Beck, but he also played drums for Elliott Smith on the XO album, which is just one of the masterpieces of Elliott Smith. And so I like that because suddenly you're getting a different class of contributor to a McCartney album, not these sort of classic British session dudes that he has, who are very awesome. You know, I'm not knocking that. It's just a refreshing thing to see these names who are associated with, for me particularly, not only amazing musicians in their own right, but bizarrely musicians like Elliott Smith, who effectively was a Beatles obsessive, and his entire musical output was a dedicated sort of extension of the Beatles chords. That was his obsession. So then you've got this guy who's born out of the Beatles with his drummer, and now his drummer is feeding back into the McCartney albums. So I really like that. And I just also like the American feel of some of these songs as a result of that. Getting these people in there. I was reading before we got on the line to talk to each other about their first trip to, or one of their first trips to America, the time that they met Elvis.
And
And what a story that is. So there's if anyone wants to read a sort of really nice condensed account of it, I'm reading this book by Craig Brown, who has just written a Beatles book called 1, 2, 3, 4. It's just been released. Mm. But this is actually in his first sort of non-fiction book that he wrote called 1, 2, 1, which is one-on-one encounters between interesting people. And this is an encounter which is Elvis Presley meets Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
And so they're talking about the Beatles going to America, and one of the interesting things in the sort of opening paragraphs of this piece is when they were in New York, the merchandise was quite bizarre. I didn't realize to what level the sort of oddities that were out there. So you could buy cans of Beatle breath New York.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you seen that? I've never even heard of that before. How did they justify that? Where were they claiming the breath was being breathed?
I guess it's easier to disclaim it, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, they must have had something. They must have had the little, because you could also buy little patches of all the bedwear that if they stayed in a hotel, they would usually strip the beds and chop them up. And I go to, do you go to that website ever, tracks.co.uk?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Oh, what a site. I mean, that's awesome. So I thought I would have spotted some beetle breath on there by now, but that's completely...
That'd be pretty rank by now, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I wouldn't want to take that in. I don't know if you would open it, though. Like, you wouldn't buy that to smell beetle breath. Have you ever bought anything off Tracks?
I've sold something on it, but I'm reluctant.
You've sold something?
Well, yeah, wow. I'm reluctant to say it because somebody gave me TV special around the Beatles, and I know someone who was actually in the audience and they had a ticket, and they said, "We know how much you love the Beatles, and you're probably going to frame it, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I probably will, yeah," and let's leave it there. And I do feel terrible. I've repented.
No, I think that's good. It's getting it out there. I bought a, it's called an artist's proof, which I'd never heard of before, but of a photo. So the artist's proof is the first one they do to, and it's of the Beatles in Hamburg, and it's signed by Astrid.
Wow.
And it's the one where they're sitting against that sort of tram, you know, where, and it's Pete Best, and it's, you know, a classic shot. I think it's almost on the front of Anthology 1. I managed, that's the only Beatles proper merch that I, you must have something great, right?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I had a similar conversation. Oh, you know Jeff Lloyd, don't you? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We were talking about this very thing, about how merchandise, once people know you're a Beatles fan, come your birthday or come Christmas, you're invariably going to get a piece of toot that's got a picture of Ringo on it or whatever. And he was suggesting that there should be a Beatles bin that you can get all this stuff that you get on Christmas Day. I just sort of quietly put it in this bin. But yeah, I'm not a big merchandise fan, to be honest.
So you don't have any kind of rare, you don't have a... Ringo breath can.
No, I don't, no. Much as I'd love to. You know, if I could afford it, I probably would. I think I like the music more than the just looking at stuff, perhaps.
No, that's cool. No, I'm a collector, so my dream is to get a John Lennon original print signed by him of those, of, you know, the illustration he did of when he was in the Amsterdam hotel room for the bed in. Yeah, I really want one of those. They go for quite a lot, but... I think one day I'll try and sneak one.
Yeah. Well, they were impounded by the police.
That's right, for being rude, right?
They were very rude, yeah.
So
I don't know what happened to those after that.
They're still circulating. I mean, you can see some even on Tracks, the website. I went to that room, by the way, in Amsterdam. I don't know, did I mention
this
already?
No.
I don't know if I mentioned this on the show. Yeah, I was... So with my podcast, we toured Europe last year, and we stayed in Amsterdam, and I called them up while we were there, because we had a day off, and called the hotel and said, "Do you still have the John Lennon room? Can I come and see it?" And they said, "Yes, if no one's staying here tomorrow, come by and we'll show it to you." So you can drop by the hotel, and if no one's staying there, they bring you up, and they let you hang out in it for, like... half an hour, and it's completely Leninified.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's got everything on the walls, which are, in fact, they have one of those prints signed by John on the wall. They have all the photos framed. There's a big bedspread which has a sort of embroidered Lenin and Yoko drawing. They have,
of course, it does.
What was on the windows. Yeah, I mean, it's properly, you can't really experience it as a pure thing of just going into the room.
No,
but yeah, it's it's very cool. Anyway, Certain Softness.
Lyrics are incredibly ambiguous. Paul sounds like he's spellbound, and it seems some kind of femme fatale. You don't really want to use the word bewitched, but is it about Heather? The lyrics to the middle eight, which is absolutely gorgeous. If I could even find the words to tell you, I wouldn't want to anyway, because that could only break the spell, and you know very well I couldn't betray her. So is he singing this to Heather about Linda, about betraying Linda? Or is he singing about somebody else, about betraying Heather? Very weird.
You know what? You bring up one of the paradoxes of Paul's career post Linda's death, which is, you know, this is a guy who, it is one of those utterly pure love stories, isn't it? You know, the one or two nights they spent apart from each other was because he was in jail in Japan, and I can't remember if there was another night, but, and then the total emotional breakdown, followed by the recovery, followed by this turbulent Heather relationship, and it's just, who is he writing these songs for?
Yeah.
Really, and I think that's absolutely bang on what you're saying there about I couldn't betray her with these true thoughts. And you know, he went into something that was quite destructive. He must have known. But, I mean, I guess, where do you go after you've met the love of your life? It's so tough, and it must be so tough as a musician as well, because you have to move on in life. Everyone craves company, and Paul got married quite quickly, I seem to remember, after we're not talking like a year, but it was quite quick, wasn't it, that he sort of got with Heather. So, you know, that sort of, people will kind of go, whoa, that was, you know, quick or not. But it's when the music comes out, you suddenly go, okay, this feels betrayal, doesn't it? Because, you know, on Driving Rain, when you're hearing the song Heather, which I must be, it's in the category of Ringo-rama for me. I must be one of the rare people who love Driving Rain. And I do love that song. Thank you for lying. I remember, you know, Driving Rain had that cover photo, which is one of the worst covers any album could have. It was taken, this new technology, it was a digital watch that could take a photo from the watch.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And that's him on the toilet, I think. He's taking a picture from him having a piss.
The Who's Next cover.
Them taking a piss as well?
Taking a wee on this obelisk.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. Oh, there must be a whole collection of urinating rock stars.
Over to you, Twitter.
I wonder if I could think of any more off the top of my head. There must be someone sitting on a toilet as a classic album cover.
Oh, isn't Millie Jackson? I seem to remember.
Who's Millie Jackson?
Hold on, I'll show you it. It's a pretty horrible cover. Millie Jackson toilet, I guess, do I look for? Yes, I do. I don't know if you can see that.
Oh, brilliant. All right, we've got a gallery going on here.
Yeah.
This is great.
Anyway, I digress.
But yeah, and my dad bought me one of those watches, the McCartney.
Wow.
Yeah, because I was so into. He was into technology and the Beatles, so that was a kind of love for him as well, where it kind of got given to me. Mm. But yeah, that's such an interesting point. That line, I couldn't betray her in this lyric. I wonder if he must just fight with that all the time. And if you follow him on Instagram and so on, he's constantly pushing, you know, great retrospectives of Linda, the whole vegan movement, obviously her company, which makes fantastic sausages. I don't know if you've ever had a Linda. Oh, love them. I went for 2 years. I went, not vegan, but I went vegetarian. And I basically existed on Linda McCartney products. The lasagna, fantastic. The sausages, stunning. But God, poor guy. I mean, you know, and when he did that romance covers album after Memory Almost Full, the
Kisses
he wrote
on the Bottom.
Kisses on the Bottom with My Valentine, that beautiful song. But you're just saying, oh man, like, I almost at this point just want the vague love songs where it's about someone else, you know, he loves her kind of lyric, because you just, I can't, it's unbearable to think what he went through. And these lyrics are, you're so right. God, that's a scary lyric to read. What is he hiding, even from his wife now, Nancy, who seems to be awesome and really nice, but musically, who's this guy writing songs for? God, that's suddenly the deepest song on this album. I didn't even know it until you said that.
I bit my tongue. I never talk too much. I tried to be so strong. I did my best. I used the gentle touch. I've done it for so long. You put me down, but I can laugh it off and act like nothing's wrong. Why pretend? I think I've heard enough of your familiar song.
Riding to Vanity Fair.
This is probably my favourite track on the album, I think. Musically, I really enjoy where he goes with the melody. It's that really nice riding, the orchestration that sits on top of it. It really plays into the song so nicely. And then there's the bit where he gets to talking about friendship and how hurt he is and how his attempts have been pushed away. The definition of friendship.
Apparently ought to be showing support for the one that you love. And I was open to friendship, but you didn't seem to have it. While you were riding to Vanity Fair.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a pretty...
It's heavy.
...big line.
Yeah, it's a massive line. And it's matched perfectly with the tone of the song, because it dips into a whole new territory, which it's been cruising quite on a theme all up until that point. And weirdly, the music sounds a bit more light, like it's trying to push a point up. Like you can physically feel that the song has sort of, someone's taken it in two hands and held it up a bit closer to your ear, as if to make that point. And it's, so lyrically, actually, this is the one where I listen to most, because sometimes the lyrics, as I say, someone who doesn't fully listen to lyrics, they pass by me, even though if I hear the words, the meanings aren't coming into it. But this is one song where he's demanding I listen to these lyrics, because it's a really important point that he's making. I think this is a really, really beautiful song. Really into this one.
This is almost Paul's How Do You Sleep? Because there's a lot of anger and vitriol in here.
Interesting.
It's either about Heather, or it could be about his publicist, Jeff Baker, who'd recently been sacked. He'd had his demons or whatever, so that didn't work out. But he'd been with Paul forever. So the thing about friendship could be about Jeff. But you just can't help think it's about Heather, for me anyway.
Yeah.
But I can laugh it off and act like nothing's wrong. But why pretend? I think I've heard enough of your familiar song. I tell you what I'm going to do. I'll try to take my mind off you. And now that you don't need my help, I'll use the time to think about myself. You're not aware of what you put me through. But now the feeling's gone. But I don't mind. Do what you have to. You don't fool anyone. It's not McCartney we hear that often.
No, yeah. And again, it's its storytelling, which comes out really subtly but really nice. What's the opening line? I bit my tongue.
Bit my lip and you put me down.
Bit my lip, that's it. I remember reading that him and Nigel were sort of... He had that line and he wasn't really expanding on it, and Nigel was sort of saying, come on, there's more here. Let's. And then this whole song kind of exploded off the back of it. I don't think Nigel liked this song. Am I right in saying that? I think he...
He didn't initially. He said the first line's good, but after that... So Paul basically rewrote it. And again, it's that subservient Paul. Who's ever said that to McCartney? Nah, Macca. John Lennon, maybe.
Yeah.
Not many others, I would have thought.
But that's, you know, in TV, I've been in many, many meetings back when I worked in development for the BBC and other big houses, where you would go and see a commissioner and you would pitch them an idea. And they would say, oh, I don't like the idea, but that, you know, that first little thing you said, it feels like there's a concept in there. And you would ditch your whole reality show TV because they said they liked these three little words. I mean, that's what this feels like. It's like he's responding to a commissioner's request of, you know, oh, the first line's pretty useful. Could we get rid of the rest, Paul McCartney? I think anytime you say something where you know that it's a sort of like, that's not good enough, it becomes a scary sentence when you add the words Paul McCartney at the end of it. You think, wow, yeah, I don't know if I could say that. I don't know if I could tell Paul McCartney that that's not good enough.
No.
Yeah, it's an all right song. Paul McCartney? No, I'm never saying that to him directly. No way. That's danger zone.
Yeah.
I think I could say it to Ringo, though. I think.
Oh, no. You wouldn't have the heart, though.
God, I love him. I love him so much. I hate seeing all the sort of backlash kind of, you know, when he sends those videos out about don't send me any more mail the fact that he talks mainly in peace and love, peace and love. He is still, if you see him interviewed, one of the funniest guys.
Yeah.
He's so quick and he's so witty. And, yeah. My dad met Ringo once in Hong Kong.
Tell me more.
And it was not long after Lennon had died. So my dad's a hairdresser, as is my mum, and they had a salon in Hong Kong. And Ringo was in town for a tour. And again, it was a few months after John had been killed. And maybe it wasn't a tour, but he was in Hong Kong for some reason. And he needed a beard trim. That was it, just a beard trim. Wow. Yeah, so my dad shut down the whole salon, and he what should have been really a 10-minute beard trim, he managed to eke out into over an hour. Because he just thought, when am I ever going to get this chance again? Yeah, and like me with my meeting with Paul, he doesn't really recollect what was said, because he was kind of nervous, actually, about being allowed to have sharp scissors near the face of Ringo. And weirdly, it's a weird thing to say, but particularly not long after the assassination of John Lennon, where, you know, things must have been heightened for the Beatles. Would you allow a man with... And my dad had extremely sharp scissors. They were forged by samurai in Japan. They were...
Whoa.
Yeah, he had samurai scissors. And he still uses them. He's used them for over 30 years, and they still have not dented in sharpness to the point where, yeah, you're meant to go as a hairdresser. You're meant to have your scissors. You're meant to have your scissors resharpened every 4 or 5 years, something in that period. Every time he's gone to have them sharpened, they've said, "There's nothing we can do. These are as sharp as the day that you first used them." Yeah. So he was really worried that he was, you know, the nervousness would slip up and he would cut Ringo, and that would be seen as an attack on Ringo. Actually, just while I'm on this little memory lane thread, in Hong Kong, my dad used to live on a place called Lama Island, and it was this little island which was off the mainland. And sorry, my mum and dad lived there. And one of their neighbors was a guy called Robert Freeman. And photographer. So Robert Freeman took not only some of the best album covers, let alone photos. I mean, he did Beatles for Sale. He did Rubber Soul. He did With the Beatles. He also did all the design work and photography for Lennon's In His Own Right and for Spaniard in the Works. Yeah, he was so. So this was this became a really good friend of my dad's.
Wow.
Yeah, and we have in our family home, and actually in most of the Schreiber family, because they all knew him, my aunties and my grandfather and my grandmother, we all have a print of the with the Beatles, the black and white, with the four of them, signed by Bob Freeman, all framed. All of us have that same print in our houses. I don't have one because I was too young, but in all our various families, houses around the world.
Superb.
Yeah, and they were really good buddies. And actually I have one photo which I'm in, which Bob Freeman took, and he took it of a neighbor. So this is very bizarre. our neighbor in Hong Kong, when we lived in Hong Kong on Hong Kong Island, there was a lady who was in a relationship with this guy. They lived next door to us, and she was a model, and my parents used to get they used to do posters for their salon with models where they would do the haircut. So she became one of the people that they did the hair of, took photos of, and Robert Freeman was the photographer for this session. And so I was just born at this time. I was really young. I must have been, you know, 9 months old or something like that. And there's a photo that she is holding me in this photo, and it's a shot by Robert Freeman. So that's in its own right really cool. But what's doubly cool is she broke up with this guy, and she moved to Denmark and married the Prince of Denmark. So she became the Princess of Denmark. So I have a photo with me as a baby in a shot being held by the Princess of Denmark by Robert Freeman. It's a pretty cool ass photo.
There's not many people who can say that, to be fair. Wow.
But this one last thing, the reason I went down this Robert Freeman thing, when I was talking earlier about all those weird spiritual connections that the Beatles like to have, you know, supposedly when George Harrison died, Olivia Harrison said that he achieved enlightenment. His body, where light came down and he sort of ascended, which is a beautiful claim to hear. Did you read that? Well, let me finish this story and I'll go back to that. Mm. But my dad was talking to Robert Freeman about the death of John Lennon. And he said to my dad, he said, it was the weirdest thing. On the day that he died, I was in my studio and I was just doing some work and I heard this huge crash and I turned around and my favorite picture of John that I had framed on the wall had fallen from the wall and smashed onto the ground. And he said, and it was not long after. And I thought something's gone horribly wrong. And I got the call not long later that John had been shot in New York.
Wow.
And, you know, I personally don't believe in that kind of stuff, so I'm not presenting this as a factual story, other than it's a factual story that this is what he told my dad had happened. But yeah, just a nice little nugget that Robert Freeman sort of had a big moment where he thought John had died, and then it turned out that he had. So how did we get onto this one?
That was talking about Riding to Vanity Fair.
Oh, I was giving Ringo shit, and then I took it back because I love Ringo, and then I remembered
that. I think you were just reminiscing.
Yeah. Does this happen on the show? I feel like I've really destroyed your show here.
Okay. No, it's awesome. You lift up my spirits, you shine on my soul. Whenever I'm empty, you make me feel whole. I can rely on you to guide me through any situation. You hold up a sign that reads, follow me. Next we have track 10, Follow Me.
Yeah, I like this song. I think it's another one that I can fast forward, except for the fact that it halfway through gets to this wonderful orchestral down the road alone, down the path of love, through the woods of heartache to the end, on the shores of again, you know, he's done that Elliott Smith thing of he just gives me one moment in a song where I don't want to miss it when I hear it starting up. I think, should I move on?
Yes.
We're going to get to this wonderful bit. Yeah. But it's not a song that's really left an impression on me, I have to say. What are your thoughts about it?
Well, it's one of the first songs. So this was from the first session. So it's still got, as we were talking earlier, it's got Rusty Anderson and Brian Ray from the band. So it's still the old Paul McCartney. This was the basically what Nigel was telling Paul not to do.
Mm.
And I think you look at what Paul was playing on this. Acoustic guitar, Rusty Anderson and Brian Ray. And Paul plays Hofner bass guitar, Epiphone Casino, electric guitar, Epiphone Tecan acoustic guitar, Ludwig drums, percussion, block, tambourine. So, wow. And again, what I love about this is when Nigel Godrich was saying, you know, I want to get your hands dirty, he meant doing, you know, recording a tambourine, which he probably hadn't done since the 60s, really, just overdub and overdub. Right, no, I just want a bit of tambourine here. And, yeah, I love
so
that.
So cool. That. Yeah, that is so cool. But that's the whole joy of the album right there. That singular moment of Paul on a tambourine is why I think if you love this album, you're attracted to it, because you're hearing Paul just in every single note of this album. He's behind, except a couple of bongos and the duduk that we spoke about earlier. It's Paul. And I didn't know that. Like, for example, that's now made that a much better song for me, that I know that he's on the tambourine there. I just think, it's so intimate. Yeah. It feels like he's really just given his all to this.
Yes.
And you feel like that's a rediscovery of loving the minutiae of an album, you know? Like, because you know he must have that. He must have the fact that he produced the Bonzos for which was the classic song.
Urban Spaceman.
Yeah, Urban Spaceman. And he did his brother's stuff. And as a producer, he must love to get into the room and go, let's just add, like when I saw him with his son and he went in to join in on the bongos because he just thought, okay, we need an extra pair of hand. And the joy, there was a joy that he had when he was playing the bongos across from his son and they were looking at each other and they were pushing each other for different pattern beats and they were both smiling at each other. And it was a really, it felt very like, wow, it feels really a privileged position to see him experiencing a connection musically with his son, because you can see it with other musicians, but there was something very sweet about that. Just going, he's a dad as well. And here he is with his son making music. Like, how cool is that? Like, you know, and as someone who loves music as much as he does, he must have just so much enjoyed bashing a tambourine for this album and not have it being done by, you know, whoever else. No, it's a good song. Again, though, it's not one of my favorites. The fact that it was part of a sort of the old album that should have been, that could have been on Memory Almost Full. But it's got the Nigel, again, when it gets to that break, it's just wonderful. Down the road alone and us. Yeah. Brilliant.
Looking through the backyard of my life, time to sweep the fallen leaves away. Like the sun that rises every day.
Next, we have track 11, Promise to You Girl.
Then I'll see. This is like the other upbeat song of the album, I think. Yeah, and it's got that old rock and roll feel, which again, as I was saying before, I'm not that keen on. I'm not into their obsession with Buddy Holly and the like. So it does start like that, and it does have him doing his "Hey man," like it's him being quite playful. I'm trying to think of Beatles songs where he goes into that kind of territory, and it's always in a sort of Maxwell Silverhammer kind of, Lady Madonna, exactly. Lady Madonna, that kind of tone.
Yeah.
He's kind of got that tone going in this song. So again, in this song, you've got this big kind of like, this big jaunty, big riff that's carrying on. And then it just breaks down again. Like, most of these songs have this beautiful break, and there's a guitar solo that I believe it must be him playing if he's majoritively playing this album. And this beautiful, almost Beach Boys-esque harmony that comes through. Every single second of my life. It just has vibes of a sort of a Beach Boys beautiful harmony, or it's just a really chill, because the song starts with that line, looking on piano, I think it is, and then like the sun that comes in, and then it comes in with this with which I often hate when Paul does that to us. I hate when it's sort of like, oh, it's orchestral, this is going to be great, and then suddenly he just throws in this upbeat tempo thing that I'm not overly keen on. But it works perfectly in this song because he returns to those motifs that he has set up right at the top of the song. And that line, what's the line? Looking through the backyard.
Looking through the backyard.
Yeah, looking through the backyard of my life. It goes with the cover, which I really love. The cover of the album is a photo taken by his brother, which is looking through the fence of Paul. Beatles era, I'm guessing from memory. I haven't seen the cover in a while. 62. Just sitting in his backyard, and he's, strumming on his guitar or bass. And it's such a wonderful shot, such an intimate shot, an interesting choice to pick for an album cover. You can see the laundry hanging on the line above him, and he sort of squat down. And this is a guy. Where were they in 62? What album were they on at that point? Was it Please Please Me or?
They hadn't even recorded. They were really still recording Love Me Do.
Was 63 Please Please Me?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So this is just before life explodes, basically. Yeah. And it's such a great photo. And that line is the line that is directly referencing that photo, the cover shot. So I really love this song despite, and actually, no, that's wrong. I love it for making me like his jaunty rockabilly kind of stuff, because it just blends so perfectly. And there's a really lovely guitar solo, which is so understated, where it's just this like he's not doing much, but it again you can hear his fingers doing it, which is just lovely. So this is if I was ranking the songs on this album, this would be in the top three, I would say.
Yes, I agree. And it's nice to hear that jauntiness as well. There's a section in 1985, which is on Band on the Run, which is very similar. And he's kind of yearning back to that on that, like the sun that rises every day.
Beautiful bit, Oh, that is so, I love that song. That's quite Fine Line as well, that piano.
Yes. That was the thing I was going to say about his piano playing, which somebody said to me once. I used to be in a band back in the 90s, and I played keyboards, and I'm left-handed. And after the performance, somebody came up to me and said, "Are you left-handed?" I said, "Yeah. How do you know?" And they said, "When you play the bass notes, they're twice as loud as the chords, because I'm left-handed." And you can hear it on so many of Paul's songs on piano. The bass really pounds.
That's so
cool.
Because
he is left-handed.
Yeah.
That's where the strength is. It gives him a unique sound.
Yeah, completely. That's so interesting. Left-handedness is... So that's the reason for Ringo's interesting drum style as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
I did a fact on the podcast that I do, No Such Thing as a Fish. It was about Ringo. And it was a fact that I got from Mark Lewison's book, from Tune In, which was that when he was younger, his grandmother, who was known by the family as the Voodoo Queen of Liverpool and probably people around town, but she performed, according to Lewison's book, he gives so little, I wish he expanded on this, she performed exorcisms on him in order to get rid of his left-handedness because she thought that the devil was in there. And who knows what the exorcism were. It could have been as something as light as just making him write a lot with his right hand. I doubt there was an exorcist vibe to it. But so he for a long time was right-handed, but then he gradually went back to left-hand, but he plays still on a right-handed drum kit. Mm. And he gave interviews where he talked about how when he went to go to the other side of the kit, because he's left-handed, he's leading with a different hand, and it takes sort of a little microsecond for him to get across. And that's just so interesting with what you're saying about Paul, that's a defining feature, the left-handedness, because the power is in there for the piano. I've never thought of that as well. That's so cool to know that about. I'm going to listen out for that with the piano to see the heavy the heavy bass notes come out.
As I say, 1985 is probably a good example of that.
That's such a good song.
Plus that gives me an excuse to play it now.
Yes.
I'm very sure this never I met you, and now I'm sure this never happened before.
Next we have This Never Happened Before.
I love this song. I think it's such a beautiful ballad. Orchestral arrangements in it are stunning. It's really nice, and another one of those songs where, thank you for letting me talk about it on the show today, because having looked into it, I read a little story that during the sort of early stages, before there was the final piece, Paul was having a massage in America.
Yeah.
I think it was America. And the masseuse was talking about how much she loved the song. Paul's having a massage. How do you relax during a massage? Let me play my songs, my unreleased, half-baked, not fully finished songs. And this song came on in the background, and she said she loved it. And he said, well, he wrote to her, I think, saying, if you like it so much, you can play it at your wedding. And he sent it to her, wonderful, the wonderful power of Paul to be able to just go, oh, if you like it that much. Like, she probably was just, she liked it. Did she like it enough to get married and have her first dance to it? I don't know. But then you've got the bonus added, you've got the bonus thing of you're playing for your first dance an unreleased Paul McCartney song, which he has personally sent you a copy of. So that's wonderful. So I read that story and I re-listened to the song. And in my head now, I'm picturing a couple dancing to a song in front of their friends, to a Paul McCartney song that no one knows, that no one in the world has heard outside of a few people inside his studio. And again, I went from loving this song to now it has a real sort of visual that I can attach to it, which enhances it by 10. I'm coming across as so sentimental with all this stuff. And maybe with the Beatles, I just really, really am. I just find every bit of their mythology and everything. It's my, Tune In when that trilogy, it's not a trilogy, is it? It's going to be a two-parter.
It will be one day.
One day. When that's finished, that will be, for me, the Bible. You know, that's the great story that's been told on this planet. It's a lame thing to say, but when you love the Beatles that much, that's what it is. And this just adds to it, a couple standing at their most beautiful day, telling each other they love each other. And there's a Paul song in the background. It's just great. This is the way it should be for lovers. They shouldn't go it alone. It's
not so good when you're on your own.
And the lyrics as well. This is the way it should be for lovers. They shouldn't go it alone. It's not so good when you're on your own. And that really reminds me of, have you read the A.A. Milne, Us Two, about Winnie the Pooh?
Well, years ago, not in a long time.
It's one of those that I struggle to read all the way through before getting a, whoa, okay. And, yeah, Paul's kind of veering into that territory.
Yeah, I think that's great. I'm going to read that poem again now.
The thing for me, yeah, it's primarily in the minor. Ultimately, it resolves onto that beautiful major during the chorus.
It's so nice. It's
amazing song.
And the lyrics, you know, again, seeing it now as a wedding song, it's, I'm very sure this never happened to me before I met you, and now I'm sure this is never. It's just great. It's really simple, but when you listening to it just on its own, you think, okay, yeah, lovely song. Put it into a context, and this guy's built to write songs that are just suited to making life better and enhancing moments. Like I listen to that now and think I would happily have played that at my wedding for a first song. If I'd known at the time to look at it in that way, as it was, we did Bowie, but I would have loved it.
Which one?
We started with Absolute Beginners, the BBC live version, which when he played at the BBC, it's just better. It's just so much better than actual. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You've got Mike Garson on the piano, and it comes through in a way that it doesn't on the song. The mix is drowning him out on the song. When you hear the piano, he goes, you know, classic Garson kind of piano styles on it. So we did that, and then it cut to Let's Dance. We had one of those moments where the song broke and we're like, what's going on? And then suddenly then the Let's Dance came in, and then
brilliant.
That was great. It was huge. But, you know, this could very well have been in its place.
Do this with a blessing. There you go.
Oh yeah, there we go. Yeah.
If you love me, won't you call me? I've been waiting too long. In my soul is constant yearning, always singing this song.
So we end with almost the last song, Anyway.
Anyway.
Does this remind you of anything at all?
Ooh, anyway. Wait, what does it remind me of?
Do you want to play a bit? Hold on.
That's so good. Wow. Okay.
Very similar.
Okay. Has there been any? Has there been a lawsuit with that one? Or
no? I think it's a homage, perhaps.
Was that a big song for Curtis Mayfield?
Yeah, that was one of his big ones. Yeah.
No, really.
Oh, Paul would have definitely heard it.
So he'd know it. Wow.
Yeah.
God, maybe he was channeling George Harrison again when he wrote it.
Even in the afterlife, George couldn't help himself.
Can't help himself. Mate. Paul, seriously, stop channeling George. He's just ripping off left, right, and centre. I don't mind the whole ripping off stories. It doesn't dent my interest in ability at all. What was the great one of Lennon doing that with Come Together? And then he had to...
Oh, You Can't Catch Me.
Yeah,
that's but what Chuck was
this?
Berry.
Was it the song he did with Julian, which he had to?
Oh yeah,
it was
Yaya.
Yaya, man, that is not an apology.
I know. Come on, Julian. Yeah.
That's not in any way useful. Interestingly, when you first asked me to come on here, I was going to try and cheekily suggest a Julian or a Sean album, because they've been very big albums in my life. Into the Sun and Photograph Smile. So Into the Sun by Sean Lennon, Photograph Smile by Julian, both came out on the same day, which was seen as an attack by Julian from Yoko specifically. He doesn't blame Sean at all for it, but those two albums, as much as the Beatles albums, have been part of my almost monthly listens. You know, I'll always go back to them. Yeah, I think Photograph Smile is an astonishingly good album. And Into the Sun is young and fresh and just different and so bizarre, and was made with his girlfriend at the time, who was part of a band called Cibomato, or Cibomato. And yeah, I was going to try and sneak them in somehow.
Go for it.
No.
You have.
Well, yeah. Yeah, so let's quickly run through those tracks. So yeah, it starts with...
Yeah, right. Track one.
But yeah, no.
Anyway,
Anyway, I don't mind that sounds like Curtis Mayfield. It's a beautiful song.
Yes.
And it's got David Campbell, Beck's dad, involved in it. Joby is back for it as well, doing the orchestras. Anyway, you can make that call. You feel free to make yourself at home. Yeah, it's a nice ending. Again, it was a bit annoying because I did think that this album ended with The End of the End, which isn't even the last song on Memory Almost Full. I've misplaced it completely. If it was at the end of that album, that would make sense. But
well, this is like exactly like this for me anyway. Is sort of ending his relationship with Heather for me, because the lyrics are, "If we could be closer longer, that would help me. Help me so much. We can cure each other's sorrow. Won't you please, please, please get in touch?" And apparently this was about a phone call he was waiting for from Heather that never came.
Oh, wow.
So it's quite a sad, a distraught Paul. You know, after... This is what weird about this album for me. It's a lot of heartfelt love songs saying, you know, "I will do anything to make you happy." And lyrically, it doesn't seem like he's getting treated that well. You know, you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
So on that side, it's quite weird. But what you were saying about at the end of the end, and it's a theme through so many of his songs, the penultimate song is his last song, and then he'll throw on a cheeky little, "Her Majesty's Pretty Nice."
Yes, yeah.
As kind of a, that isn't, it's like a coda more than, I always think his penultimate songs are his last songs, so.
That's so interesting. Yeah, why does he do that, do you think? What's the...
I don't know. Well, it goes from, Her Majesty... Pretty well every album, if you go through.
Yeah.
You check out the penultimate song. Like Flaming Pie, you know, Beautiful Night is a great, powerful song.
Oh, and man,
And then he's got that follow-up, Great Day, which is almost just like peering through the door. Oh, just before you go, just put this on. You know, that's how it feels for me.
Maybe it's exit music. It's just a little... Yeah. It's the lights have gone up. In the stadium, and that's when you know it's over, when they've got the background music coming back on. It's we're all waiting.
I mean, the bonus track we're talking about is "I've Only Got Two Hands."
Okay.
So what are your thoughts on this little nugget?
Should have opened the album with it, really. No, it's Chaos. There's Chaos and Creation as its title. It's probably in the period of the last examples of a hidden track. We can't really do that anymore with online stuff. You know it's a hidden track when suddenly the final track is 27 minutes long. That gigantic gap of silence before it reaches it 16 minutes later. So that's quite nice that it's sort of one of the last generations of hidden tracks. And weirdly, it sounds a bit sort of Fireman-y, I guess.
Yes.
I wonder if that was that a trailer to, you know, coming soon. Kind of Paul McCartney.
Piece of music on the album Rushes. It's a song called Bison, where Youth is actually playing bass, and this is really recalling that. It is, as you say, pure chaos.
Yeah, it's bizarre, and it goes particularly in that second half of the song. We were talking earlier about Nigel Godrich playing the looping. That feels like something's broken halfway through them playing. And they're desperately just trying to turn it off, and they don't know how. And then later on in the evening, they accidentally listen back to it and went, wow, that's, you know, put that out. Someone will work out what we were doing there. That's a lucky mistake, like the opening piano chord in that song. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really listen to that bit of the album, I have to say. That's not really, I can remember, but you had to play it back to me just now to sort of properly remind me. It's not something I ever stick in for. I mean, what's his intention, do you think?
There were so many bonus tracks around at the time. Do you remember the Stone Roses Second Coming album? The bonus track on that?
Yeah.
And there are different ways of doing it. I think their track, the final track was track 13 or whatever. And then there were track 14, track 15, and then when you got to track 99, then you'd get the bonus track, and it was pretty much what we've just heard, just absolute chaos.
Wow. How long would it take to get to track 99 if you left it?
I think
it?
There were 5 seconds.
Oh, okay, right.
That's
cool, though. I like that. That's fun. So,
yeah. One thing I do love about this album is, in a bid to stop file sharing networks, promo copies were issued. The title was just Album, and the artist's name was Pete Mitchell.
Cool.
Just so people would... And it was that. That was, you know, prior to the official release date. This was Album by Pete Mitchell.
That's so cool.
Quite charming.
Pete Mitchell. That is really nice. I like that.
So, Dan, overall...
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this pretty wonderful album?
I think it's up there with his best. I think it tapped in to the genius songwriter that he is. And I wish it also is just something where I look at it and go, I just wish he could be thrown into these circumstances more, where he's sweating in the studio. Yeah. He's pissed off. He's angry, and he's forced to bleed out these amazing songs. I love his stuff generally, and I'll listen to every album. I thought Egypt Station had fantastic songs on it, and the fact that he can be busting out those kind of tunes at his age is definitely something that needs to be factored in as a really impressive, amazing thing. I think, and then I also think we're lucky that he's still making the music. I think, you know, so many people sort of say, oh, you know, stuff's not as good as it was back in the day. And they'll say that about every artist. They were saying that about Bowie for years. They'll say it about the Stones, any band that's out there. But what they don't do is they don't listen to the albums and discover that sometimes in what might be a lot of dross, there'll be one gem which was as good as the thing that they did back when they were hailed as the greatest thing on the planet. Mm. And Paul is constantly doing that. There's just moments and full songs where you just think, this is as good as the Beatles, or if not as good as the Beatles, this is just far better than most other people can achieve. And I'm just so happy that the story continues, that he doesn't just stop and say, okay, that's enough, you've had your fill. Because it's we're living in the time of potentially one of the greatest songwriters of all pop history, we may never see anything like the Beatles again, and we may find that it's one of the few things that makes its way, like Mozart and so on, into the future. And what a privilege to be able to go to the store and buy a new album by this guy who changed our lives. And it's so interesting, like that wedding song, which I'm really, it's changed that whole mentality of how I want to look at Paul McCartney songs, knowing that that was played at a wedding. I went to see Paul McCartney live back in about 2008, something like that, and I saw him a few times. And there's a moment, if you haven't seen Paul live, there's a moment halfway through the gig where something hits you that should have occurred to you that didn't quite occur to you until that moment, which is this guy wrote everything that he's playing. All these songs that are the greatest songs ever written.
Yeah.
He wrote, this guy standing there singing this. We're like, this is like watching a god from Greek mythology come back to do a gig. Like, this shouldn't be a thing I'm seeing with my eyes. He should long be dead. How is that possible that this is that good? And I think Chaos was a beautiful moment where we got to experience him in a later stage of his career, coming out with something so fully formed, so beautiful, so deep, that we haven't necessarily had from him either side of that album for quite a few albums. And so it to me, it's a biggie. It's an album I go back to all the time. I can sit through it nonstop. It never gets old for me. There's a new detail in it always to push an emotional button. I mean, and again, the research, I'm going to research all his albums now. I think it's just sitting in a canyon, writing a song, First Wedding, the piano that was used on Lady Madonna. They're tiny things, but if you're a fan, they really add to your interpretation of the song. So I love this album. I really think it should have, it did sell like a million, I think, but that's probably a standard amount for someone like Paul. I'm glad to see online that actually people who love the Beatles and love Paul rate it as highly as I do. I thought I was picking an obscure thing. You're going to tell me next that Ringo Rama's in the top five of most Beatles lovers as well, but probably not.
You're welcome to come back and talk about that anytime. Dan Schreiber, thank you so much. It's been awesome.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's been great. Hey! Hey!